Waiting out a hurricane with my family this past week got me thinking about one of the most important cars I ever met in my life, a 2000 Mazda 626. Come on inside and I'll tell you more about it.
This week's song is all about Rachel because this car is all about her. It's Ziggy Marley, Who's Gonna Drive You Home. It's a great Cars tune that he covered for the 51st Date soundtrack, and we were listening to this song a lot together in this car. I like every time I hear this song, I think about that Mazda. If you hadn't heard it, you should go check it out. Even if you don't like covers, just give it a listen. Come on inside.
Welcome to the Wrecking Yard. I'm Jerry Wayne Longmire. Let's just jump right on in today. I had to apologize. The set's probably a little askew. Things are a little off here. I'm sure my eyes are still a little bloodshot. I'm looking a little rough. We have had a week here in Houston, Texas. Last Monday, on my birthday, Hurricane Beryl come through Houston, Texas, a little Catwarm storm, and knocked out everything, you know? It's wild. Houstonians got a lot of questions, and we're all kind of on edge right now. But it's been a week, and my family, very fortunate, actually just got our power and lights back yesterday. And that's why I'm recording this the day of, you know, I'm trying to get it out there for you guys. But yeah, it's been, so sorry if I look a little rough. It's been a week, man. Been through a lot of hurricanes, a lot of storms in Houston, Texas, and me and my wife have certainly weathered a lot of ups and downs. But it just gets that when your kids are involved too, it just gets scarier and scarier, and there's nothing like, you know, seeing your kids looking worried. That's something you don't ever want to see as a dad. So, like I said, it's been a week. Before we get too deep off in today's episode, which is about a 2000 Mazda 626, and y'all going to have to let me wing it a little bit on this episode. I wrote the script twice over the course of this week, but, whoo, there was so much else going on, it's just I didn't get to tweak it a lot, you know. Yeah, I don't even actually have, I'm working on this little thing here, but all my projects are big right now, you know. I got a fence to fix and a roof to fix, and so I don't have a lot of little projects right now, or at least none that are taking any sort of priority, because once again, we made some jokes and a reel about it, but literally have cleaned this property up a number of times this year from some kind of storm, and whoo, buddy, I got oak limbs out there stuck in the ground like lawn darts, you know. Before we get started, we're going to read some comments. Oh my God, we're going to read some comments. And I got an update on last week's story about the raccoon DWI. And oh my God, I was, you know what, we'll do that last. We'll go through the comments and then we're going to do that last. You guys are going to love that though. All right, here we go. Let's see. What do we got here? Excuse me. Adam in Western Mass. It's nice to hear the compassion for the other people in your town that gave your dad a hard time for taking the transfer. That would be lost on a lot of people. Well, Bubba, I mean, I've just come about that sort of maturity in the last 5 to 6 years, to be honest with you. 10 years ago, I'd have been ready to tell them all to kick rocks. But, you know, the older you get, and the more you hear, and the more these kind of situations you go through, you start to realize people on a good day, we're not great animals, right? We can be mean and cruel and petty and all these things, but then you throw in a situation like that involves fear and losing your job and unsuredness, and then we get real nasty real quick. Even the nicest people in the world can. I bet Mr. Rogers could have been a little bit much to deal with on a real bad day, even himself. I don't know. I shouldn't say it. Sorry, Mr. Rogers. He seems like a nice fellow. But yeah, you understand what I'm saying. People could be a mess. And when I was sitting down to write that and really thinking about that time and what my parents were going through, what my dad was going through in this town, and it dawned on me, it's like these people were scared. They were losing their jobs. They didn't know what to do. They were just lashing out. And I think most of us are guilty of doing that at some point. I've certainly seen a lot of it this past week in Houston. And you'll see a lot of Houstonians angry and lashing out in certain ways right now because they're going through a hard time. And I think when you're not going through a hard time and you're able to look at those situations, sometimes it, if you can add some kindness to it, maybe you can help that person get through whatever they're going through. It's kind of that, you know, we all see that internet meme about be careful how you treat people because you never know what they're going through. And that felt like one of those situations. Like I needed to mention that, you know, these weren't bad people. These were good people. They were just going through something terrible and they reacted poorly. And they took it out of one guy who made a good scapegoat because he was leaving and he did get the job. So I get it. Thank you for that. Let's see. What's next? Bam, bam, over here, turning damn Dr. Phil. All right, Matthew D. Imperio 589, who lived in the Midwest and remembers being so aggravated with those rusty rear wheel brake cylinders and just plugging the line from the brake booster. Well, we can't be advising people to do that sort of nonsense, but I will tell you, once upon a time, when I decided I'd had enough, I lived in Milwaukee, Wisconsin for a while. Nearly got pneumonia, nearly died. And when I decided I'd had my fill of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and get ready to come home, I had, at the time, that's a whole other story, but at the time I totaled my truck, and I had bought this little Mercury Lynx from a junkyard, like a little late 80s Mercury Lynx. And boy, it was a piece, right? Anyways, the brakes started giving me problems on it about a week before I was getting ready to leave Milwaukee, and I didn't have no extra scratch to do anything about it. So I took the brake line off brake caliper, the one that was going bad, and I jammed a nail up into the brake line and screwed the brake line back on. And them brakes worked pretty damn, I tell you what, them brakes worked for the next week. And they worked all the way to Kenosha, Wisconsin, where I blew the engine on the way home. So the car didn't get far. I gave that car to the waitress at the bar I had to go to wait for the train. Was it a train? Yeah, I had to catch a train. No, I had to catch a bus down to Chicago and then catch a train. It was a mess. But yeah, I blew that car up in Kenosha. I mean, like NASCAR style, too. You know what I mean? Like, I was just getting it running down is it Highway 94, maybe, or Highway 95. And I was just getting it, boy, just brrr. And when that little engine blew, I mean, it just shot oil right up the windshield and all over and just smoke just boom. I just edged over and coasted into this little honky-tonk parking lot, gravel parking lot. I forgot about that little car. All right. Thank you for the comments. Thank you for the feedback. I love you guys. Also, right here, probably where the sponsor go. I ain't got one yet, but we got a couple people we're talking to, so there probably will be one soon. I'm not going to waste a lot of energy on it today because ain't nobody paying me yet. But I cannot wait to get back into the raccoon story. Because holy... I mean, you'll hear comics say this all the time. You'll hear comics say this all the time. The funniest things are the true things. And I'm a big fan of that. It's one of the reasons I like doing this show, because this is a show where I'm mining for the truth. But I'm actually writing a lot of great stuff because of doing this show. It's a good exercise for me. And the truth, like when you're looking at things and you're getting ready to tell a story, the truth is right here. And then right there is the funny. It's always right under it. It's like right there. I mean, you gotta scratch at it a little bit, but the funny's always there. And that raccoon story is a perfect example, because we goofed and guffawed, and I made my little silly jokes about what I think happened that ended up. And then the young man that sent me the story to begin with sent me the police report from Camp Pendleton about what really happened. And right off the bat, I'm gonna tell you I was wrong. It wasn't a Marine. It was a Navy. It was a seaman. It was a big old seaman did this. Navy man. Right? I can't even believe this. I was sure that was a Marine. But one of my other buddies, he's a Marine as well. And he said, well, you know, the Marines ain't got medics. So I don't think it's a Marine. And sure enough, he's right. He was dead on as a Navy guy. And I'm going to just read this police report to you because it's the funniest thing I've ever read in my life. I was howling by the time I finished reading it the first time. All right, here we go. 26th of September, maybe 2015. I can't tell what year it is. This is an actual police report from Camp Pendleton. Abuse of public animal, drunken or reckless driving. Camp Pendleton, San Diego, California. September 15th. Male, Navy enlisted first class petty officer exited a bar intoxicated in an attempt to drive a POV equipped with a breathalyzer interlock system. Suspect was too intoxicated to successfully start the vehicle, so he went into the park where he captured a raccoon rummaging in a trash receptacle. I really like, what's too drunk to use a breathalyzer machine, but not so drunk you can't snatch a raccoon out of a trash can. That's a fine level of intoxication right there. All right. So he went in the park. He captured a raccoon rummaging in a trash receptacle. Individual utilized the raccoon to blow into the interlock system successfully, but the raccoon became unconscious from being squeezed and was discarded on the floorboard of the vehicle. Until a short time later, when the raccoon regained consciousness and began to attack the suspect while driving, causing the vehicle to crash into a residential fence, the vehicle came to a complete stop at an in-ground swimming pool. The suspect sustained numerous scratches and bite marks to the hands, face, stomach, and all. That raccoon woke up and kicked his ass. When I read the part about the discarded raccoon and the floor, where I was like, oh, here we go. Here we go. I've tangled with some raccoons before. Ooh, buddy. That's one of the funniest stories I've ever heard in my life. Thank you so much for sending that to me. I am a changing person just because I know that now. It would have never. I have been lit. I have been in some situations. And never in any of them situations have I taken it upon myself like, you know what? I need the help of a small woodland creature to get through this. It's never happened. All right. Let's move right along. My cover the sponsor thing. I cover the sponsor thing. Whew, I'm tired, y'all. All right, here we go. Oh, where's my little chisel, actually? I'm going to find out before we get too carried away here. So I'm not having to dig around through. Where is my... Oh, there we go. No, just sharpen this booger. Where were you at in 2005? I know where I was, mostly. I was at 1952 West Gray in Houston, Texas, formerly known as the Laugh Stop Comedy Club. It didn't matter if it's day or night, I was there. I had fallen in love with stand-up, and I was deep in it. I'd started comedy at the Laugh Stop in like early 2004, right after February 2004, right after meeting Ralphie May for the first time. We hit it off, and he told me about the open mic on Monday nights, and I got addicted to it. I threw myself into stand-up. I tossed my non-destructive testing career in the trash. And that's a whole story for a whole nother vehicle, really. This ain't even about that, other than say that at this period, I'm in stand-up 24-7. I'm living in my car about half the time. The owner of the club would let me work during the day doing repairs on the club because I could do some stuff, maintenance. And then I also I'd manage the Monday night open mics and the bar on Monday night. And did a little bit of bartending there, but mostly I'm on stage. I'm on stage, I'm traveling, I'm in Houston on stage all the time. I'm getting a feature for all the right acts. Every names that are huge names now were paper acts back that day, and I'm featuring for them every week. I'm showcasing for, you know, the Montreal Festival. And I'm blowing and going, baby. You know, I got me a little, honestly, I've got a little side hustle supplying party supplies to like-minded individuals. We were all doing a lot of that. And I was probably, honestly, if I want to be honest, real honest with myself, I was probably headed for a Hedberg hotel stay, which it's an all too common ending for young comedians. I don't know why that is. I'm sure somebody, maybe we're just messed up a little bit, but a lot of comedians die young. I don't know if it's lifestyle or maybe the tedium of the job sometimes. This is around the time I kind of got off. I was using a little bit of the nose candy, or not a little bit, but I was enjoying experimenting for a couple years. And this is about the time where I got off of it too, though, because I've always a big boy. And I can tell you a lot of it had to do with wanting to change what was going on in my life. And a lot of it had to do with realizing it wasn't serving me anymore. But a lot of it goes back to some friends making fun of me. You ever have somebody just ruin something for you? One of my best friends in the world is a comedian named Slade Ham, and I'm sure you've seen stuff I've done with him. I went with him to Africa to entertain the troops and all that stuff. We've been friends for a very long time. Many, many, many years ago in the early 2000s, Slade was very instrumental in helping me get my career off the ground in the beginning. He was one of the first clubs that worked me. He gave me some of my first travel gigs. He owned this fantastic comedy club in Beaumont, Texas, called Comedy Texas. It was a great club. It was so much fun. Sorry, I need a little something here. Anyways, I was at that club one weekend, and it was pretty common knowledge. The comics, when you're comics, we all know things about each other, and we all knew who was partying and who wasn't. And I had a reputation at the time. You know, I was going pretty hard. It wasn't doing some of my best work after the show was over, if you catch my drift. And it was, like I said, it was open knowledge amongst other comedians and stuff like that. We all knew what everybody's vices were. That happened to be mine. But one night after a show in Comedy Texas, I was there and I was featuring for Ralphie May. And we will talk more about him in another episode about a different car as well. But Ralphie was really good to me, and I loved working with him, and I learned more about stand-up comedy from Ralphie May than probably anybody else on the planet. That's not true. Vic Henley. Vic Henley is my real guy. But Ralphie, right after, he taught me a lot about performing, and really good dude. I don't really care what anybody else's opinion of him is, because I watched him be a generous, kind soul for a long time and do a lot of good things for a lot of people. Regardless, Ravi had a little bit of a mean streak, too. You don't want to play the dozens with him. He'd been a big boy his whole life. You couldn't get that guy, catch that guy off guard, right? But we're standing outside the club, just featured for Ralphie. We had this killer show. I already got my little package. I'm going to go back to the hotel room and, you know, do my thing. And or maybe sit at the bar, have a couple of drinks, slip off the bathroom every once in a while, and just keep myself straight enough for the drive home. But Ralphie, and we were all standing in the parking lot, and Ralphie says, "Hey, man, we're going over to Louisiana. We're going to go to the casinos and go gambling. You want to come with us, Jerry Wayne?" And him and Slade were standing right there, and I said, "No, that's not really my bag. I don't really like to gamble." And Slade Ham, so fast. I'll never forget how fast he did it. He looked right back at me and he goes, "You're 250 pounds and you do cocaine every night. Don't tell me you don't like to gamble." And you know what I'm saying about somebody ruining something for you? I was like, "Oh," we laughed it off. And then I got back to the hotel room at night and was like, man, I pulled that little package out and was like, all I could think about was Slade Ham saying, "You're 250 pounds. You do this every night. Don't tell me you don't gamble." And I was like, "This is a gamble. This stuff's going to kill me, you know? I like Chris Farley. I didn't want to be him, you know? I like John Belushi. I don't want to be him, you know?" And I'm not saying I quit that night. I definitely did not quit that night. But it just stuck in my head, and I just couldn't even really enjoy it anymore. And there were other reasons too, but I always remember that as being one of the big catalysts that, like, he just put it to me in a perspective I hadn't looked at it the right way in. And if you haven't never done any of that stuff, great, continue to roll that way. If you did, hope you got away from it. That stuff will steal your joy. It wasn't a hard fight for me. That's one of the easiest things I ever quit doing. There was much harder things I quit doing, but that wasn't too bad. Whew, I wish I could quit Twinkies. I got quit that. It's easier to quit drugs sometimes because really all you got to do is clear out your phone list and delete the numbers of all the people that you hang out with to do drugs. Then it's pretty easy to quit drugs. It's hard to quit cigarettes and food and all the stuff that's readily available because you can't just pull out your phone and delete every stop and go within 2 miles. You know, it's always right there in your face. Anyways, enough about that. Just telling you all this stuff so I can kind of set the scene here. So this is that time period. Me and Rachel know each other at this point. I want to be clear about that. Don't get me wrong. I already had some serious feelings for her, but we had a little fling night or two together and things hadn't worked out, but I was still pretty kind of wrapped up in her. But she was exploring other options and I was too. So we're not really together at the beginning of this, but we're very close. We spend a lot of time together. And Rachel's dad, who you'll hear me talk more about as we go on down the line, my father-in-law, Kenneth, was an incredible, talented man in a multitude of ways. And one of those ways was that man could buy and flip and sell cars like nobody's business. Some guys just know the business, and he had a knack for it. He'd even had his own little dealership at one time. And when I first met Rachel, she was driving, I think it's a 97 Jeep Cherokee. And whoo, that was a problematic piece. And I had worked on it for her, and we'll talk more about it another time. It's part of a whole other set of stories. But her dad had gotten fed up with the Jeep. She's living down here in the big city. She had come back here from Midland, and she'd been to college at Texas Tech and all that good stuff. She'd come to the big city, got this job. And her dad, you know, as any good dad, was concerned that she's driving around this beat-to-death Jeep Cherokee that was just, it was struggling. It was leaving her stranded here and there, and she was having issues with it, and I'd helped her with it some. And one of the most difficult problems I ever solved in my life was on that daggum Jeep Cherokee. Still mad at that truck. So her mom had this 2000 Mazda 626 Black Onyx Leather Edition, fully loaded. I mean, just pimped out, everything you want, the power moonroof, you know, just all the options that you could get. And I think it only had about 70, maybe 75,000 miles on it. And her mom bought a brand new Nissan Maxima. And her mom and dad, who even though they were divorced, agreed that they would just give that Mazda to Rachel so she had a reliable car to drive around while she was, you know, starting her new job running the comedy club. Or not a new job. She'd already been there a little bit. So, Pop takes the Jeep Cherokee, sells the Jeep Cherokee. I didn't call him Pop then, though. I was still terrified of him. He was a terrified man. Woo! Pop takes a Jeep Cherokee, sells it, and Rachel gets the Mazda. And I'm telling you, I still got a thing for her, man. And she was bad in it, too, Bubba. Let me tell you, she'd pull up that comedy club, her music bopping, and that power moonroof down, them blue eyes sparkling. She knew she was bad. Woo! She was so interested. I think one of the reasons I was so hung on her was because she was one of the first girls I met that she had like this serious dichotomy, because in her heart of hearts, she's a sweet country girl from Texas. and believes in family and animals and all that good stuff. And she knows about horses and dogs. And she was more than just a pretty girl, man. I told you, she was kind of a country girl at heart, but she was also sophisticated and cool, man. She was hanging out at all the top events in Houston and, you know, photographed with big celebrities and stuff at the time. She ran all the comedy club stuff. She was the boardroom president, but she was also the girl that you just wanted to go hang out in a pickup truck with and ride around and tell jokes to. She had it all. And I guess that's what I was trying to get at with that. But we were not together. She was dating somebody else, and I started dating someone. We'll talk about all that, but I still had it bad for her. I'm going to tell you that, man. In fact, me and her, we were kind of trauma bonded too. And that's like a whole other thing. We were trauma bonded because we both worked under this guy named Pete. And Pete owned the Laugh Stop Comedy Club in Houston, Texas. And Pete was a narcissistic, alcoholic rage monster. He was our friend, but you ever have one of those friends you don't introduce to your other friends? Pete can give you the shirt right off his back, but he's going to want it dry cleaned and back in his closet in the morning. You know what I mean? He was a lot to deal with. He yelled and hollered, and I would have to defend the wait staff to him. I almost got in a fist fight with him in the kitchen of the Laugh Stop one time because he wouldn't stop berating some little bartender about a very simple mistake. And it was because he drank too much, and he had some anger issues. And most club owners, this is a common thing. Bar owners, club owners are usually their own kind of monster a lot of times. Not all of them. I've met some genuinely wonderful people who own and run venues and manage venues. But there are more times than not some kind of narcissistic nightmare at the top of that organization. It's just, I'm sure you've seen it too. You've known bar owners and stuff like that. And Pete, boy, he was one of the craziest ones I ever had to deal with. And me and Rach had to deal with him on a daily basis. We were basically the closest to him at that time, you know. And I worked on the club during the day, and she ran the club. She was hired as the general manager of the Laugh Stop. So she was the general manager, and she was buying talent and dealing with all the agents and all that good stuff and dealing with all the celebrities and the talent that came into town, and then also running the wait staff in the bar. And her job required her pretty much working nonstop, and I was at the club all the time. So we were definitely, even when we weren't together or we weren't trying to date or anything like that, we were together all the time. So I couldn't escape her, and honestly, I didn't want to. You know, I still had a thing for her, but I had kind of decided I wasn't going to pursue it, you know. I didn't feel like I had much to offer her at the time because she was a young person with her head on her shoulders, squared away pretty good, and I just had a feeling she was off to do big things, and at the time, I was partying pretty hard, and I thought I was off to do big things. I had this big plan. I was going to move to New York City. I had already kind of found a place. I was going to go to New York City and further my stand-up career. But the problem was I wasn't really working on my stand-up career at the time. At that time, my dumb ass still thought the job was just to drive places and be funny and then take substances after the show. That was the gist of what I thought the job was. And I didn't put much more thought into it than that. And I was blowing and going, and I cost myself some opportunities, getting too drunk, too high, stuff like that, missing out by people that did want to take a chance on me at that time. I remember one time I got put in a room with some important people, and they're like, okay, what's your idea? And I was like, what? And they're like, what's your idea? And I go, what do you mean? And they said, well, like every comic wants to do a sitcom or something. They have an idea, something they want to make. I had no idea. I just wanted to go on stage and be funny. But I decided, and then they picked the guy next to me who had a really dumb idea, and he wasn't really all that funny. And they picked that dude. And, of course, he ended up losing the gig or whatever it was, the deal, because it wasn't good. But they picked him because he was ready and he had an idea, and I didn't. And my friend Mr. Bob taught me this one time. It was his little rules for success. And one of them was pop, publish or perish. And Mr. Bob used to tell me publish or perish all the time. And ever since that moment, get caught in that room, I was like, I'm never going to get caught like that again. So I'm telling you, I ever get put in a room again, I got about 8 scripts on my laptop. I've got one sheets written for shows I've come up with. I created a show that's like a wrecking yard show, a junkyard show, me going around the country to old wrecking yards. And rather than buying their stuff, helping people sell their stuff and get money for their prized cars and stuff. All them old men got some prize hidden somewhere. So I decided that's never going to happen again. I ain't going to get caught with my pants down like that again. But at the time I did, I'm blowing and going. Rachel, she's making moves, man. She's running this whole comedy club by herself at a very young age. She's a beautiful woman. Many men just falling all over themselves every time she walks by. We're not together, but we're spending a lot of time together, and we're spending a lot of time in that Mazda together because we'd run around and do errands for the club during the day. I remember one time, that's why I picked the song I picked for the intro, because one of the ways me and her did, she was a music person, and I love music, and I shared with her, I had just seen the movie 50 First Dates with Adam Sandler, and, you know, people love to hate on him, but I actually think he's a pretty great guy, and anytime I see somebody that's loyal to their friends, especially as their success continues to grow, I can't help but be a little enamored with that. But in the 51st Date soundtrack, they had all these cool 80s songs covered, I don't know what you call it, Hawaiian style or whatever, and there was a cover of a car song on there called Who's Gonna Drive You Home. It's just one of my favorite songs of all time, and we had some moments because of that song. And, oh, the Blue Jays is loud today, guys. Man, the storm screwed them up, too. I remember one time, it was a big week at the comedy club. This is still at the old Laugh Stop. It was a big week because Pete had scored Andrew Dice Clay. Andrew Dice Clay wasn't even doing a lot of gigs at the time, but he was coming to Houston, Texas to headline the Laugh Stop Comedy Club, and it was a big deal. I mean, he was one of those comics that came with a contract writer of all these things, and I don't know, you know, who wrote his contract and all that good stuff, but I will tell you, Andrew Dice Clay was one of the most surprising people I've ever met in my life, in real life. And I'm not going to sugarcoat or lie, I wasn't a big fan of his comedy. I really didn't know much about it. I was a Kinison guy, and him and Kinison didn't like each other, and so I just never got into him. But I knew he was a big deal. I knew he was very famous. I knew people loved him, and people were going to, I knew the club was going to be sold out. And me and Rachel were running errands in the Mazda to get the club ready for Andrew Dice Clay. And, you know, I'm telling you that, but we were listening to this soundtrack, and I was having big feelings about her, but I had decided to, you know, just not move forward on that because I just thought it was foolish at the time, and she was dating somebody else, you know. But one of the funniest things about the Andrew Dice Clay thing coming to the club, and I don't remember if it was in his contract rider or if they just do it for an appearance or whatever, but somewhere in the paperwork, we had to hire 2 escorts, and they were escort him to the stage, 2 lovely young escorts, and they were going to escort Mr. Dice Clay, I don't know how you say it, to the stage every night when he went out to do a show. But what would be funny was, you know, you hear these stories about the guy and you expect this level of debauchery and this rude, caustic person, and he is one of the sweetest, kindest people I've ever met in my life, and also, honestly, one of the funniest in person. The guy is really, really funny, like off the cuff, sitting around jack and jawing, and I got many opportunities to chit-chat with him that week while I was working at the club. But you would go up into the green room, and instead of this scene of debauchery and partying and stuff that was going on, it would be Andrew sitting there, or Mr. Dice Clay, I don't feel like I know him well enough to call him Andrew, but he would be sitting there playing cards with these 2 escorts and eating cookies. He had these cookies they liked that they had brought up to the green room, and eating cookies with Andrew Dice Clay. And I had went up there and sat with him, and he was watching me. He was, you know, like any good comic, he was observant. And I can't remember exactly what he told me, but he gave me some of the best advice anybody's ever given me in the matters of the heart. Andrew Dice Clay did. He told me, he looked at me and he said, so are you going to do something about it? And I said, about what? And he said, about this thing you got for this girl. He didn't know me or Rachel from Adam, but he knew he had already picked up where my head was at. And I said, no, you know, I just, you know, I don't really have my things together yet. And it's just not a good time because I'm trying to focus on my career, all the stuff I thought maybe he wanted to hear out of me. And he goes, ah, stupid. He said, if you're feeling this way about her, that I can see it on your face every time you walk in a room, if you don't make a move, if you don't find a way to get that girl in your life, you're going to regret it the rest of your life. And I don't know if that's verbatim, but it was something along those lines. I couldn't believe Andrew Dice Clay is telling me how to, you know, manifest this relationship. and at the same time, I got Pete breathing down my neck because Pete had this thing. Look, there's an unspoken rule at comedy clubs. That's not true. It's spoken all the time. I can't tell you how many times managers of comedy clubs or owners of comedy clubs, you show up for the first time to play a room and they meet you and shake hands and explain pleasantries. And then they would say something along the lines of, don't screw my wait staff and we'll get along just fine. Because a good waitress, way harder to find than a decent comic, believe it or not. You can make a phone call or replace a comic in about 5 minutes. Finding a good waitress, that takes work and training and time. You can't just replace them. So Pete's breathing down my neck. She's not for you. You can't date her. Don't dip your pen in the company ink, that kind of thing. And at the same time, I don't really care about that, but it's adding another obstacle to the situation. But I keep seeing her pull up in that black Mazda, boy. And I keep getting in that car with her, and we ride around, and we hang out, and we spend time together. The time that it requires to build a relationship. The time you spend talking and sharing things with one another. And she was dating this guy, and he was a rich dude from California. And he was flying her to Vegas and, you know, just doing all the right things. He was an older dude, but he was being nice to her. He was treating her right. And he wasn't a bad person by any stretch of the imagination. But I found a chink in his armor. I found a chink in his armor that I wasn't even aware of. So that's 2000. This is like 2005. Last part of 2005, I get hired from a private party to show up as Santa Claus for the kids in a Santa Claus outfit and hand out gifts to the kids. And then they have asked that I, after they run the kids out of the room, I do a dirty Santa Claus stand-up comedy show for this group of people. This is fine. I'm good at writing for a theme. I'm good at doing whatever I need to do, you know. At that point, I needed to survive. So I was taking a lot of gigs, and whoo, that was a big money gig. And so the event was happening at the restaurant. I think it was called Le Jadet. It was like French Vietnamese cuisine. Well, but it was this place right next to the Laugh Stop over there off West Gray. So, and Pete had rented the Santa Claus suit for me, had it at the club ready for me. At the time, I spent a lot of nights crashing at him and his wife's house. We were all friends, and I would crash in their extra room. And he rented this outfit for me, so I go up to the comedy club, and I get the Santa Claus outfit all on and everything. And unbeknownst to me, Rachel and her dude is in town visiting, and they have come up to the comedy club. And I will never forget the look on her face when you had to come down out of the green room, downstairs, open the door, walk into the lounge. And I stepped into the lounge with that Santa Claus outfit, and her face registered something a little different. I don't know if that Santa Claus outfit started hollering at her ovaries and was like, hey, make a baby of this guy. He loves kids. Something like that. But I went over and said hi to her, hugged her. She hugged me really tight, and we kind of had a moment. It wasn't like a long one. It was just brief. And I said hi to, you know, Mr. Fancy Rich Pants and shook his hand and, you know, told myself he wasn't a terrible person. And I went off and did my gig. What I didn't know at the time was Mr. Fancy Rich Pants got worried. Mr. Fancy Rich Pants noticed. He picked up on the moment because apparently they went home after they went and did their stuff together, went home, and all he talked about the rest of the night was asking her questions about what was going on with me and her. And she was like, nothing, you know, we're just friends, and you know, but I guess maybe we weren't. It was Sorry, I'm having to use some notes today. So I thought, I don't know, in my head, we texted a whole lot right after that. We were talking back and forth a lot. And so in my head, I was like, ooh, what's going on here? And so I started feeling things about her, guys. I started going, you know what? Why can't I go after her? And I was really excited because there was a Christmas party coming up. And it was like a server staff, what are you going to call it, industry Christmas party at a bar we all hung out on West Gray called The Wet Spot. The irony of that is not lost on me. Had a lot of good times at The Wet Spot on West Gray. It was a bar owned and run by all professional bartenders. And they were trying to do it a different way. I don't know exactly what happened to it. I think there's a condo complex there now. But there was a Christmas party coming up at The Wet Spot. And I was excited because me and Rachel were going to get to have some quality time hanging out together. And The Wet Spot had also hired me to come stand on the bar and do a comedy show during this Christmas party. You know, and they had this big old U-shaped bar. And I just walked around the bar doing stand-up. And it was packed, bro. We had people all the way outside, da-da-da-da. And I was so excited Rachel's coming because I'm going to get to do this show and look like Mr. Big Shit. And then we're going to get some time to hang out together. And we've been talking a lot, you know. And Mr. Fancy Pants, he's back off in California doing whatever it is he does when he's not there. So I'm like, here's my opportunity. And then Pete did something. I don't even remember what he did, but he did one of his normal caustic rude things, made her work too late, yelled at her a bunch of crap that he didn't do. And then by the time she got to the Christmas party, all the food was gone and stuff. And I think she was just tired and irritated, so she left. She went home. I remember standing in the parking lot watching her drive off. I was so disappointed, but I still had to go do the show. So I went and did the show, and I think I got a little mad, you know, if I'm being honest, whatever, because I had these ideas in my head that maybe were right, maybe weren't. And that night, I met another young lady named Breck, and we started hanging out and spending some time together. I kind of gave up. I just was like, well, this just doesn't seem like it's ever going to work out. But there's this other lady that likes spending time with me. I was never like head over heels for Breck or anything like that, and she wasn't for me at all either. I think we just both kind of needed some companionship. We did. It's worth noting that we never slept together. We got drunk and spent the night together a lot, but we never had sex. And I don't know if that's because I still had feelings for Rachel. She knew, you know. She made jokes about it. One night when we almost did, I started kind of laughing it off, and she said something along the lines, are you going to laugh about it, or are you going to call Rachel and ask her for permission? So she knew. You know, women know. They know when you're not 100%. You know, and she knew I wasn't. But we started hanging out. We were spending time together, you know, and kind of doing our own thing. And in this time period, we had to close the old Laugh Stop. It was one of the longest standing. It was like a 30-something year comedy club. It was one of the longest standing comedy clubs in Houston. We had to close it. And we're going to move it to a new location over on Wall Street. And Rachel's running all that. But the last night the old club was open, I featured for Jimmy Schubert, who is still, to this day, one of my favorite comedians to watch. He's one of the funniest people I've ever met in my life. Just a delightful human being. A little wild, but just a good, funny guy, okay? And so I'm happy I'm featuring for Jimmy Schubert the very last night the club is open. No, I was hosting. I was emceeing, maybe. I don't know. I know I was one of the last people on stage in that club before they shut it down. And because there was not going to be a build out there, we were going to take everything that meant something to us about the club. And I still have the sign that hung outside the club on the building. I backed my pickup and took an angle grinder and cut that sign off the building. And I still got it. I also got a square of the open mic carpet that I cut out and kept. And it was just an emotional night. All of us that were so attached to that club and had so much invested, all the comedians, all the staff, everybody, because it was the end of an era. And Breck, for whatever reason, Breck showed up, she got irritated about something, probably something I did, and she left. And I was hanging out in the showroom, and Rachel came to the showroom, and she was in tears because she had found out I had decided not to go to New York. And one of the things she always told me was she didn't want to have a relationship with me because she didn't want to get in the way of my comedy career, because she really believed in me. And she didn't want to be part of anything that slowed that down. And she came to me that night and she was in tears. She was furious with me. She was so mad at me. She thought I wasn't going because of Breck. It didn't have anything to do with Breck. It had to do with money and actually some family stuff. My Uncle Terry had just died, and I was, or no, my Uncle Stanley had just died, and I was having big feelings about family. It had nothing to do with Breck. That's not why I was not going to New York. I had just changed my mind and decided that wasn't the right move for me. But Rachel was furious with me, and she was crying, and she was just so angry with me because I wasn't going to go. And I had to tell her that it wasn't because of Breck, and there was just lots of reasons I wasn't going to be able to do this right now. And I remember that was the first night I realized that there was more than meets the eye between us, that she was really invested in me. And nobody had been really invested in me in a long time, especially a woman. It hadn't been that way. I had had some bad relationship stuff, and I wasn't even 100% sure I was that kind of guy that wanted a relationship anymore. But I knew that night that she was invested in me. And we talked on the phone all night after I went home. I remember I turned down party supplies that night. Jimmy and everybody wanted me to go party and have a good time with them. And I was like, nah, I got to go home and charge my phone because I'm talking to Rachel. She already had some importance for me in that level. I mean, I had it for her bad. I'm honest enough with myself to know that. One of the things that turned, well, after we started building the new club and started working on the new club, right under the new club on Wall, there was a Subway sandwich shop. And what I didn't know about myself at that point in my life yet is that I am allergic to mushrooms. Not all mushrooms. There's some mushrooms I can eat and have a great time. A great time. But for whatever reason, the mushrooms that they tend to put in food when they're cooking make me sick as a dog, violently ill. It almost looks like food poisoning. It's so bad. And I ate a meatball sub from the Subway shop downstairs one day, and Pete was paying me to work on the new club, and I was helping out with projects and getting the new club ready. And I remember I ate that Subway sandwich, and I started feeling bad, brother. I mean, I didn't know what was going on with me. It was in my soul, though, I was feeling so bad. Another train. Get it, son. Roll on that. Oh, that's an 18-wheeler song. Sorry about all the trains. If you're listening to this, I can't help the fact I live by a train station. Anyways, I ate the sandwich. Well, I was so sick, I couldn't do. I was a mess. And Rachel, in her concern for me, took me to her apartment to help take care of me, because she's that kind of person. She's a caretaker type person. She likes taking care of people. I think it runs in her family. Especially her grandma was so much that way. But Rachel's that kind of person. She's very compassionate, very genuine. She has a big heart. She cares about a lot of stuff. And she will always use action to show how much she cares. And so she took me, and then she called Breck for me because I was so violently ill. And like, hey, your boyfriend's over here and he's sick to death. And Breck started making jokes about it. Breck wanted her to videotape me with her phone so that she could have a laugh. And Rachel's like, well, no, I was actually calling because I thought you might be concerned, but whatever. And Rach hung up on her, and Rach took care of me until I got better. And nothing romantic, she just looked after me. It took me a day or two. I mean, I puked and pooped everything out of me, and it was all green, and thought I was dying, but she took care of me. She nursed me through it, and that stuck in your head, you know. That'll stick in your head that somebody will go to those links for you. Somebody you're not even dating go to those links for you. Meanwhile, the person you're sort of dating, you know, wants to make a TikTok about it. Of course, there wasn't no TikTok then. It was Vine. That stuck. It changed the way I thought about things a great deal. Another thing that, like, really happened during this time period was I got booked for one of my very first road headlining gigs. The very first club that ever really headlined me as a headliner is a club in Jackson, Tennessee. Now, the thing I gotta tell you is my dad's people, all my people from Jackson, Tennessee. I had a whole family in Jackson, Tennessee I didn't know about. I didn't know growing up. And I meet them around this time period. I met them at a reunion the year before. I went up to Jackson for a reunion with my family and then found out I had all this family up there. And at the same time, I had met this comedy club owner named Harvey Boyd, who was one of the good comedy club owners, one of those people I was talking about, you know, the few that are just amazing people. Harvey Boyd's one of those people, helped my career tremendously. He's the first guy to headline me. So I get this headlining gig in Jackson, Tennessee. This is in December too. This is all happening in December, like around Christmas. This actually happened before the Christmas party stuff. So we go to Jackson. No, this happened right after all that. So I go to Jackson, Tennessee, do this gig. But I go with my mom. Me and my mom take a road trip and she decides to go to Jackson with me so she can hang out and visit family while I'm there working the comedy club. And we go in my mom's Jeep Cherokee, which I also hated. One of the other worst vehicles I've ever met in my life. It was a 98. God, that thing was a piece. Anyways, me and my mom go to Jackson, Tennessee from Houston. We hang out. I have this cousin in Jackson, Tennessee. I have a delightful cast of family members there that I love and think about all the time. But I had this cousin who at the time was like 78 years old, and her name was Lowita. And Lowita was something else. Lowita Dunn worked for every governor of Tennessee. She was one of the first female telephone operators. She had letters from the governor about helping women's rights. Lowita was a pistol, buddy. She's a Tennessee pistol. A nursing home mistreated her husband. Lowita started a whole organization that became the Tennessee state arm of looking out for nursing homes and checking up on nursing homes, make sure they're not mistreating people. Lowita put all this together and started doing it on her own dime in the very beginning. She would go around and basically trick nursing homes into letting her in so she could see how they were really treating people. She was a pistol, right? And we're hanging out at Lowita's house all week, right? I'm dating Breck. Rachel's back in Houston, but I'm dating this other girl. And I'm having the time of my life headlining this comedy club for the first time ever. And Harvey was such a great guy, and I just loved all the time I've spent at that club over the years. It was called South Street Comedy Club. It's gone now, but it was a wonderful place. I just remember this. At the end of that week, when me and my mom were getting ready to come back home to Houston, Lowita and me were talking at the kitchen table with my mom. And Lowita said, "So are you going to marry that girl or what?" And I go, "Breck, no, I mean, I don't see that in the cards." And immediately Lowita looked at me and goes, "Who the hell is Breck? I'm talking about that Rachel girl you've been talking about all week." And I was, and my mom thought that was the funniest thing in the world because she knew I'd been caught. She knew where my head had been at. And she's like, "Yeah, he talked about her all the way up here." And at the same time, I was texting Rach and we were talking back and forth. And I just decided, I don't know why that was the catalyst. I wish I could tell you. You know, we all have different catalysts, things that call us to action. That was the thing. I couldn't wait to get in that car and come back to Houston, Texas. I drove most of the way so my mom could sleep, so I could just, man, I'll never forget. I'm driving to Houston. I'm trying to get to Houston in time to go see Rachel that night. I want to go see her. I need to talk to her. She's on my mind. I have to go talk to this girl. And my mom locked us out of the damn Jeep Cherokee at a gas station in Nacogdoches, Texas. I was so mad. My mom was worse about locking keys in the car. We had to wait for AAA to come, pop the lock. And we get back to Houston about midnight to my parents' house, which is out in Richmond, Texas. And now I got to get in my car and haul ass all the way downtown Houston, try to catch Rachel. And she's already left. She's not at the club that night. She's going to her apartment. And I needed to see her, so I drove straight to her apartment, and I went up to the door, and I knocked on the door, and when she answered the door, I kissed her and told her that I couldn't stop thinking about her and that she was everything that was on my mind. And she was surprised, but leaned into it. But then I was like, "Hey, also, I got to go break up with my girlfriend because we want to do this right, right? You don't want to do this while you're involved with somebody else, whatever. I want to do this right. I got to go break up with my girlfriend." So the very next day, I didn't do it that night, but the very next day, I went to see Breck at work and was like, hey, I feel like we need to talk. And I'm sure she sensed, and probably we hadn't really been getting along that great and all that stuff. It's not like we were like dating or whatever. And she goes, sure, can you give me a ride to my apartment? I'm about to get off. And I was like, sure. And then we could just talk in private, and it doesn't have to be at our job, and that'll work out. And I decided that because I wanted things with Rachel to be right, that I was going to do something I'd never done before in my life. I was going to be 100% honest with a woman. I was going to tell Breck what... I wasn't going to make up excuses. I wasn't going to tell her things that weren't true. It's me. It's not you or anything like that. I was just going to be honest with this girl because I felt like she deserved that. And I wanted to start things right. And so I drive Breck to her apartment and we go inside and we start talking and I start telling her. I was like, look, you obviously know and you have known for a while that I've got feelings for somebody else. I told her this. I told her, I was like, we have different things that we want, but I am 100% in love with this other person. And she said, she's just going to break your heart some more. And I said, well, then I need to see if that's the truth. But I'm not going to be normal until I pursue this. I'm in love with her and I can't shake it. And it's not fair to you because I'm not in love with you. And she was real cool. She was like, oh yeah, well, you know, we were just hanging out. It's not like we were serious, blah, blah, blah. We're friends. We could stay friends. Sure, let's stay friends. I'm like, well, crap. I should have tried telling the truth a long time ago. This is going great. And I was turning around and picking up my backpack when a glass ashtray flew by my head. And she started, what is wrong with you? Just yelling, going nuts on me. And I ran out of her apartment to the sound of things breaking and got in my car. I was like, woo! Never doing that again. Never telling any woman the truth about anything ever again in my life. That went poorly. Which is not the lesson to take away from that. But, you know, at the time. Yeah. That was right before Super Bowl. So this is like February. I'm sorry. I said that was December. So this all that stuff, Christmas happened December. This is February. It's right before Super Bowl. I remember it's right before Super Bowl because Super Bowl night is Rachel and me's first night kind of together out on the town. Well, I mean, we're not like hardcore yet, but we're having big feelings about each other. And we go to the Super Bowl party at the Wet Spot and to watch the Super Bowl, even though neither one of us really cared about sports. It was just, it's just a thing people do sometimes, you know? So we went to go watch the Super Bowl, and I'll never forget because I was just so hung up on this girl. And I was like, holy crap, I pulled it off. I got the girl. I got the one, you know. And Prince played The Best of You by the Foo Fighters. And it was absolutely outstanding Super Bowl show. This cover of The Best of You, he just come out and shredded it, made it his own. And I'm a big Prince fan. But then, not only that, he starts playing Purple Rain, and it starts raining. It's like somebody up there was like, this song just ain't right without the rain. Starts raining, and Prince stands out there in the rain, that little maniacal midget, and just tears Purple Rain up, and it's glorious. And me and her decided to get out of that bar as soon as that's done. She's like, let's go back to my place. And we went back to her place, and I never left. We've been together ever since. The longest times we've been separated in that time period was when I went to Kuwait and Iraq to do shows for the military that following year. And when I went to Africa for 21 days last year, as long as we ever been apart, that's my girl. She's my one. Well, we went back to her place and I never left again. And it was hot, you know, it was hot. When you're in love, you know, y'all just, once y'all get together, boom, that's it. It's fireworks, buddy. And I was so in love with this girl, I couldn't even see straight. And we were having fun. We were having a good time. And I was getting to know her family, and she was getting to know mine. And we were still dealing with Pete, but around this time period, Pete gets fired, run off from the... He had another owner in the comedy club, and they find out he's been embezzling this whole time and stealing money this entire time from the club. And so his other partner kicks him out of the business and appoints Rachel basically to take over Pete's position. And at one point, I'm not going to go too deep into this, No, I am. I'm going to get to this in a minute. So basically, he's put Rachel in that position, and he's also offered us the opportunity to invest in the club to maybe become owners, or at least partial owners someday. And we've decided that's something we want to do. Rachel's making really good money now. She's got a raise. We can afford to do this. She's pretty much running the club. We were in the time period we had the Mazda. I had about 5 different vehicles because I go through vehicle. I get bored. I switch it up real quick. But at this time period, I'm riding a 1977 Yamaha 750 Triple. And it's my little project bike. I've taken it apart and cleaned it up and painted it and got the engine running just right and put some headers on it and stuff. And it's just a fun little street bike. One of the best balanced motorcycles I ever rode in my life. It's a great little street bike. One night, but I'm not drinking a lot because drinking and motorbikes, woo, they do not mix. And I've already cut out the other stuff. I'm done with the other stuff, right? I am utilizing a little cannabis. It's about the time I got into that. Yeah, I had some adventures. This is me learning how to utilize cannabis as a grown man because, woo, I had no clue. I didn't grow up doing it with my other friends. When I was younger, I was real Pentecostal and kind of self-righteous and didn't mess with any of that stuff. And this is me learning about it. In fact, one night, me and Rach went out clubbing, partying, having a good time. We got back to her apartment, and she used to keep some in a little apple jar on her kitchen cabinet. And she went upstairs to do whatever, and I was like, oh, I'll get me a little something out of the apple jar, kind of lighten us drunk just a little bit. And I started digging off the apple jar, found this test tube, what looked like leaf all shredded up in this test tube. And so I put some in a little pipe and lit it up and smoked it. Got the worst headache I ever had in my life instantly. Whew, and it tasted awful. But Rachel's cat jumped up on the counter and was just on me like this. Oh, Boo Kitty is right here in my face like this. Like I just stole something that belonged to him. I find out when she comes downstairs, I have just smoked catnip. And this cat wouldn't leave me alone the rest of the night. That cat followed me around that apartment the rest of the night right here. Like, puff, puff, pass, brother, you know. One night over at the new club, so once we moved in the new club, me and her still staying in her apartment. We got a house over in Oak Forest. We rented a little house, had a little garage. It was our first, like, real move-in together. We moved together in this little house right there off Althea and T.C. Jester. I'm riding a Yamaha 750 motorcycle. Joe Rogan's in town. Joe Rogan's headlining the Laugh Stop. And, you know, at the time, Joe Rogan was a comedy favorite, especially at the Laugh Stop. They loved it. He had good ties in Houston, and he came quite a bit. And we always had a good time when he was here. And, boy, he could sell some tickets. And guy was genuinely, I know a lot of people have big opinions about him and what he's become now. I really don't. But back then, he was a pretty nice guy. I don't know who he is now because I don't know him anymore. But he was really nice to me every time I dealt with him back then, which was a little bit here and there. One of these nights where I'm riding that motorcycle and Joe's headlining the club, Joe had brought a bunch of treats from California, different candies. California had gone legal. They were making stuff there nobody else had seen yet. And he brought some treats. And I got given one of these treats. It looked like a little big Snickers bar. It was about that big. And I love me a Snickers, Bubba. And I popped that Snickers and ate that whole Snickers, not knowing that you were supposed to eat a piece of that Snickers. We were at the comedy club, and one of Joe's guys, I don't think it was Joe, was like, you just eat that whole thing? Aren't you on a motorcycle, man? Ooh, you got balls. And I was like, what do you mean? He goes, bro, that kicks in. It's going to be like an acid trip. And I was like, I have got to get home. So I told Rach, I was like, hey, I ate this candy, and I'm worried it's going to kick in. I need to get home. Will you follow me in your car, or we can come back afterwards, but will you follow me in your car? I'm going to get on the motorcycle. I'll head that way. Because I was full of good ideas at that point in my life, apparently. And Rachel got in that Mazda, and I got on that Yamaha motorbike, and boom, whipped out on, got on 45. I had it down, boy. You shoot up Allen Parkway, do the loop, hit 45 north, bam, catch 610. Yeah, it was all one smooth move. I could get home from that club fast, that motorbike. And there was this little section at 45 North when you're coming through downtown and off the Pierce Elevated, and it's still there today. Some of you have probably driven over it and had this same experience, maybe not with a hallucinogen-inducing candy in your mouth, but whatever. Right when you come up out of 45 North, there's a hump. There's a little hump in the freeway, and you'll see it from a mile away because it's got oil pan spots on it left and right where people have been beating it up for 50 years. And I hit that hump on that Yamaha, and I guarantee you I was doing every bit about 85 miles an hour. And Rachel saw me and the motorcycle come off the ground and just kind of land. You know, you land and your wheel's just a little bit off kilter. You know, just... And it's a little death wobble, and that's about when the candy kicked in. Woo, son. I don't know how I got from there to our driveway, but I remember I pulled that Yamaha up in the driveway and just stepped off of it and let it fall over because I needed off that machine by then. By that point, I was riding a dragon, you know, and whoo. I don't know how I made it back to that house that night. Around that time, also met one of my best friends, my buddy David Doig. I also, at that time, had a Ford Contour Sport with an AOD transmission. And damn that transmission, because I met a local builder at a little transmission shop named David. And David was just, me and him hit it off right off the bat. He liked funny. He liked that I'd come over to the shop, hang out. He worked on that. He rebuilt that. His guys rebuilt that transmission for me. And then it failed again. And then he has guys rebuild again under warranty, and it failed again. Oh, then like, I don't know how many times it failed. It failed so much that he fired one of his builders over it. He was so hot about it. And then he tore it down to rebuild it and measured the case and found out the case was warped and replaced the case, and we never had another problem with that car. David is one of the most brilliant car guys you'll ever meet. He's not just a car guy. David's into everything. David can tell you about Scottish history and castles, and there's a lot of that. I don't think we talk about that a lot. There's a lot of genius blue-collar men. We've all met them. Those guys that can have a conversation with you about anything, David is that guy, and he's a good friend. He's been an excellent friend. He was in my wedding to Rachel. And at that time, me and him were hanging out all the time. He's giving me a job at the transmission shop while I'm not making money at the comedy club. And I'm working as a manager of the transmission shop. And that's kind of my little gig. And Rachel's running the comedy club and working on that stuff. And of course, once Rachel took over the comedy club, I used to get booked there all the time. I couldn't get booked there as much because then it would look like she was showing me favoritism. So my bookings went to nil at that club. I was working once or twice a year there again, like you're supposed to do at a comedy club, but I didn't understand that at the time. But I knew why it had to be that way, because we didn't want people throwing a fit about our relationship or saying that she was doing things for me and she wasn't doing for other people. I mean, she was, but it didn't have nothing to do with comedy. So me and David are hanging out, and David's one of the funniest people. That dude's a riot. That guy knows more about cars than most people are. He's forgotten more about cars than most people will ever learn. And me and him are doing projects, man. He went with me to buy that Yamaha and helped me work on that Yamaha and get it running again. At the time, I was buying little Japanese motorcycles off Craigslist and fixing them up and selling them to make a little extra money. Or just parting them out and selling the parts on eBay, because there was a little bit of money in that too. So my garage was like a little motorbike disassembly center. And Rachel's still driving the Mazda. We're hanging out with David all the time. I won Houston's Funniest Person. It used to be a big deal in Houston, this contest every year, Houston's Funniest Person, and comics would compete to be the best. And I'm the only guy that's ever in Houston's Funniest Person history. My first year I did it, I won second place, then I won third place, then I came back and won first place. I'm the only guy to ever win, you know, the gamut, all the trophies, and I still got them. I wear them on a chain around my neck. No, I don't. I don't know where they're at right now. But I won that year. I won. I blew it out. In fact, there was another guy favored to win at the time, and that guy was doing a stolen Eddie Griffin bit about a stripper with one leg, and he was closing with it and flopping around on the floor like Eddie Griffin did, and it was a crowd pleaser because most crowds don't know a stolen joke when they hear it. And everybody had this dude predicted to win. This guy's going to win the contest this year. He's everybody's money's on him. He is the favorite. Nobody's even thinking about me. But when we do the drawing to see who goes in what order, I get to go fifth. And fifth is, in a 10-man lineup, is the sweet spot, baby. It is the crowd's warmed up. They're ready. But you ain't got to close the shot. It's like being the middle act. It's the sweet spot, baby. And when I saw that I drew fifth and that he drew sixth and was going to have to follow me, I knew. I remember walking to that stage. I was a man on a mission. I was about to level this crowd that night. And I walked on that stage. And at that point, we were in the finals, so you got 10 minutes. And 10 minutes is not a lot of time in comedy. 10 minutes can be forever, or it can be nothing, depending on the crowd and how you're doing. I've had 10 minutes that felt like an hour before, for sure, at a show that just wasn't great. But in a contest, you don't got time to reset the room. You don't got time to do anything. You just have time to go up there and do your act and make those people laugh. And you have to get to it fast. And I hit them hard, baby. I was swinging for the fences, and I was getting the laughs. And the judges were in the back row, and they're lighting up. They're having a great time. One of them's a serious talent booker. One of the other ones is Outlaw Dave, who ended up becoming one of my very good friends. Outlaw Dave is one of the judges, and he's a serious radio guy. He's been in the business for a while, and he's met a lot of comics, and they're enjoying what I'm doing. And I closed that set with a joke. I closed that set with a rant about modern country music and Garth Brooks, and I don't even remember how it all go, but it was just a rant, and it ended with me hollering that I was going to climb the steps of the Grand Ole Opry and stab anybody with a plastic fork and play "The Water's 3 Foot High and Rising" by Johnny Cash if I heard one more Dr. Pepper bullcrap dirt road country song. I leveled the room. This is Houston, Texas. These people love country music, but we're also, I leveled this room. I mean, I walked up, I nailed it. I had 2 seconds before being disqualified for going over time when I walked off the stage. And when I tell you, I laid them people out, baby, this ain't hyperbole, hyperbole, whatever that is. This ain't that, all right? You can talk to anybody who's there at night. Even people don't like me, and they'll be like, Jerry Wayne threw down the gauntlet. He leveled that room. And old dude doing the stolen joke made a huge flaw, made a huge mistake. Because one thing that I've learned about comedy over the years is if somebody's in front of you and they're killing it, do not go on that stage and take a swipe at that person. It's not going to go how you think it's going to go. Because when those people already love that person that's on stage and you take a swipe, you're psychologically telling them that you think they're stupid and what they like doesn't matter. And people don't respond well with that. And that's what this has always been my move. When somebody's killing it in front of me and I can recognize that they're destroying the place, the best thing you can do is go up there and acknowledge it, because then that puts the crowd on your side. They're like, oh, you like what we like too. Well, we already like you. It's just basic psychology, you know. If you've ever done sales or anything like this, you already know this. I go up there, level that place. He comes up after me and tries to take a swipe at me, and the crowd doesn't go for it. And now he doesn't even have time to reset the room and get him on his side. Now he's got to get into this. And he does his act, and he's getting laughs, and he does that bit, the one-legged stripper bit, and it gets laughs, but it doesn't hit like it has been hitting because he poisoned the crowd against himself. And I leveled them fools, and he came back. I won. I'm not even sure he placed that night. I can't remember who. I don't think he placed. I put it on him, you know? Like, I don't like to be a braggart, but I'm very good at my job. I've leveled some comics. Somebody called Judy Gold and asked her. I floored her for 6 shows in a row. I've leveled some comics before, you know? And I've had some comics level me. Don't get me wrong. Woo! I've had some people make it seem like I wasn't even at that show. Yeah. But I won it that night. You know, and one of the prizes for winning it was I was supposed to headline the Laugh Stop. I was going to get to headline the Laugh Stop Comedy Club for the first time. I even got my name on the marquee. It was a big deal. We got screwed out of it, and I guess I'll just tell you that. So one of the other things that happened as a result of that contest was I got asked to go to Iraq and Kuwait to go entertain the troops, which is, I told y'all before, it's where I met my good buddy Chris Shaw. And so at this point, I've already asked Rachel to marry me, right? We're in love. I've asked her to marry me. I've bought the ring. I've already got the ring. I've been hiding the ring. I done went down to Robbins Brothers, bought a ring. I'm ready, you know. I can't think of anything else but about this girl. And we got, she's got a good job. She's running the comedy club. Things are going well for me because, you know, I'm not partying and doing all the dumb stuff anymore. I'm actually focusing on what I'm doing. And going to Iraq was like a eye-opening moment for me, you know. I'd never been that far out of the country, and I got to see a great many wondrous things and meet a great many military people and have an experience, you know, that forever changed who I was. It's one of the reasons I take the military show so serious now. So one of the things was I got asked to go do that, and I was super psyched about it because I come from a military family, and it just meant a lot to me. I remember my Uncle Gary called me. He was career Navy. My Uncle Gary called me and just to tell me how proud he was that I was going to do that and how much it meant to him when he was a young soldier going through Vietnam and whatnot. So I was having big feelings about it, you know, and Rachel drove me to the airport in that little black Mazda, and we separated for 17 days, which is more than we'd been apart at that point, and it was hard. And also it was hard at the same time because the man that owned that comedy club, Jeff, that had taken over, you know, when the other partner got caught embezzling, when Pete got caught being an embezzling thief, the guy that took over that club, the guy that kept the club, had promised us we could be invested, and we had money tied up in it. We thought we were going to end up being in some kind of ownership position in that club because we had some money and we had some skin in the game. That guy decides he's not making enough money off the club, and he doesn't want the headache anymore, and he lets another club owner in town take over his club, a guy named Don. And I don't like Don. Don's dead. I'm not going to waste a bunch of energy speaking ill of the dead, but I don't like that man. We never got along. I never liked him. I thought he was rude, condescending, and arrogant. Maybe I was too. I'm sure I was. But we didn't click. And Don's first move, well, Don and Rachel didn't like that they were going to fire all the staff to bring Don's staff to take over. So Rachel warned her staff that, hey, y'all are about to be out of a job because this is what's happening behind your back. I'm in Iraq. Right. And this is communication's not as good as it is now. Like when I was in Africa, I was able to talk to her almost every day. In Iraq, I maybe got a minute or two to talk to her every couple days because they just didn't have all the technology then. And it was hard to get access to a phone or a computer. I could talk to her on the computer a little more often. But a lot of the bases we're going to didn't even have, you know, those capabilities. We're going to very small. We were going to like forward outpost bases in Tamaya and the Sunni Triangle and all this kind of stuff. We were there following Puddle of Mud and Carlos Mencia. And Carlos Mencia's contract wouldn't let him go to any of the forward outpost bases. He would just go to the big ones. And I think Puddle of Mud was the same way. So we were nobodies. Nobody knew who we were. Nobody cared. They're like, y'all want to go to these bases? We're like, hell yeah, because we didn't know that maybe we should be worried about our safety. So we're going to all these little bitty bases and stuff all through Iraq and entertaining. And like I said, it was an amazing time. And I'll talk more about that when I talk a little more about the Ford Contour, all the adventures I had in that. But at that time, the owner decides to pull this move. And when Rachel warns the staff, which I get it, but it was so, let me just say, it was chicken shit. He fired her and locked her out of the building, just fired her overnight and locked her out of the building. Then Don comes and takes over the club. Doesn't fire all the staff, but runs off a bunch of people and brings his people over and does what we knew he was going to do all along. Don owned another comedy club. Don wanted to rebuild that club and move it. But he needed a place for his people to work while that was going on. He only took over this club so that he could bring his staff over there and still earn some money and float the idea out while he moved his club, which is exactly what he did. And then he moved his club and opened it and closed down the Laugh Stop forever. Forever. I think on Christmas. Fired everybody on Christmas Day or something, or Christmas Eve, right before Christmas. It was horrible. But they did all this while I'm in Iraq. Rachel's here dealing with herself. I'm not able to talk to her. She's going through this major thing. And I'm finally learning what it's like to kind of be helpless, to be able to not be able to do anything. I want to go tear this dude's throat out. I want to, you know, yank him out of his car and throw him into Allen Parkway in the middle of traffic. I'm furious, you know. I want to hurt this man for what he's doing to her. And I get home from Iraq, and so we're supposed to get married in September. We're at this point, our wedding is scheduled. We're going to get married in Las Vegas in September. We had a wedding we had purchased at the Venetian Hotel, and our family and friends were going to fly out there with us, and it was going to be a big to-do. But now, right before the wedding, Rachel has lost her gig, and I get home from the comedy tour to find out that they've also canceled my headlining shows, even though I had contracts and all that stuff, and put the screws to me too, as well as fired me. And David sold the transmission shop while I was in Iraq. David got a deal on the transmission shop and sold it, and ended up going to work doing some other stuff, running a bunch of other transmission shops for a guy that owned a bunch of them. So I come back to no job, right? We were just broke, hanging out, riding around the Mazda every day. Smoking a little weed, you know, trying to figure out what was going to be next. Rachel, of course, picked up a job really quick because she was super intelligent, but we just decided to wait till after the wedding. I went to Iraq in June, come back, that all happens in June, July. I had picked up another little bit of work, but we're still kind of living on our savings. But we're doing the wedding in September, and we're just like, when we get back from the wedding, we'll figure everything out. But we've already paid for all this stuff. Let's just do this. Also, in this time period, I get diagnosed with Crohn's disease, and it almost kills me because I'm stressed out of my mind. I even gave Rachel an out. I was like, you don't have to marry me. You didn't sign up for this. And, of course, stubborn, wonderful woman she was, she didn't take it. She's like, no, we're in this. I want you. You want me. We're in this. So we're leading up to our wedding, and we got jobs. Everything on that front has fallen apart. We're kind of trying to figure it out, but we're mostly concentrating on what we're going to do. You know, we're trying to make some decisions. And we go to Las Vegas, and we got married September 6th, 2008. And this is what got me thinking about this car, to bring it all back around. We got married September 6, 2008. I don't know if you're good at history or if you know anything about Gulf Coast storms, but we came home from Vegas on the 10th to get ready to go on our honeymoon. We had this wonderful wedding with our friends and family. My brother was my best man. My dad, my mom were there. And it's the last time I ever danced with my mother. It's a great weekend. We have this great wedding, and we come back, and we're getting ready to go on our honeymoon. And when we get back, when you're in Vegas, there's no clocks, there's no weather channel, there's no distractions, it's all distractions. There's nothing to connect you with the real world. They do that on purpose. So we get back to Houston and get to the airport to find out that all the flights have been canceled because there's a storm named Ike in the Gulf. And it looks like it might be headed towards Houston. And I decided this was time for me to step up, show her what the husband I was going to be was. And all the way back to our little house in Oak Forest, I consoled her and comforted her. And I said, baby, I've lived in Houston for a long time. Hurricanes don't come to Houston. It's so rare. They always tell us, oh, it's coming to Houston. It's going to wipe Houston off the map. And it goes to Mexico or Louisiana. That's what happens, baby. You ain't got to worry about it. Yeah, you saw Rita, right? Rita went to Beaumont. Katrina went to New Orleans. They don't come here. We're fine. Don't you worry about nothing. And then the next day, I noticed I couldn't get my dog to go outside. Our little dog, Tina, was only about 7 pounds, but there wasn't enough of me to convince that dog to get out the door. That dog didn't want nothing to do with outside. The cats have hidden. We hadn't even seen the cats in 2 days. And all over the news, this storm's coming to Houston. Hunker down, Bubba. And we know the drill. We've done it. Hunker down. We live right off a major bayou, you know. Hunker down. Worry about flooding. The storm's coming to Houston. And all the while, I'm like, nah, I don't think it is. But now the dog won't go outside. And the cats are nowhere to be found, and ants are climbing up the side of the wall on the house because animals know when something bad's about to happen. Watch your animals. They'll tell you everything you need to know about when a storm's coming. These ants are crawling up the side of the house and making crosses. It's the wildest looking thing you've ever seen in your life. Every squirrel I see in our backyard is hauling ass north with a mouthful of nuts. And I came back in the house and said, I think I've made a grave mistake. I think the storm is coming to Houston. And she's like, what do we do? I was like, I got board up to Winders. You know, we live right off 45 basically at this time. And that's the predicted path. And so I go to Home Depot and they're out of wood. There ain't no boarding up no Winders, right? I was in the Mazda, drive around looking for plywood to tie the top of the Mazda and get back to the house. And I ended up taking our fence apart and part of our neighbor's fence apart, privacy fence, and boarding up all the windows on the house with these giant pieces of privacy fence I've taken apart in our backyard, almost all of our fence. And then I don't know what else to do. I had by this point, I had a little Honda Accord, and I pulled that Honda Accord up by the front door. I pulled the Mazda up by the front door right under the ledge of the roof of the house, and the Honda Accord up here, so they're on high ground because our street kind of went down, our driveway went down. And that storm, Ike comes on through, baby. And Ike comes on through and punches Houston right in the mouth. Got straight up 45, knocks out power for, I think we went 19 days with no power and like 12 days with no running water. And it floods everything around. I got pictures of me standing in the street in front of our house, knee deep in water. You know, it's just rising steady. And it's just pissing rain down on Houston after this storm. We were on the wet side of it. Woo, it was a mess. Now, luckily, at that time, they responded to it really quickly. They already had people stayed. They were doing all kind of things, and they jumped on it, brother. And FEMA showed up with trucks, and men drove from all over the place with flatbed trailers full of ice and stuff to help people out. And me and Steve, one of my best friends at the time, him and Joey come over to stay at our house because their roof got wrecked and their house is wrecked. They were roommates at the time, him and my brother. And so we invite them over to stay at our place. Like, we ain't got no power or anything, but, you know, at least you have a roof over your head. And that's when I knew Rachel's the one. This is supposed to be her honeymoon. Her honeymoon is 19 days dealing with my brother and my best friend and me and all our animals in a house with no electricity or nothing. And she was a trooper. She didn't complain one damn time, you know, any more than anybody else did. And me and Steve took chainsaws and went around the neighborhood and helped cut up trees off people's property. And Joey and her would go get food and ice and stuff for us so that we would have sustenance and stuff in the evening. And Steve got us a gig up in Conroe. There was a bunch of damage on Lake Conroe. He gets us a gig, and this place comes heavily into play because I end up working there for a long time at this little place called April Point South, cleaning up hurricane damage. And we're getting paid pretty good. So we're driving up to Conroe every day and then coming home to no power and hanging out and playing Monopoly and drinking on the porch and with candlelight, you know, and just doing the best we can to survive this situation. It's different when you don't have kids, too. But we that was our first storm we weathered together. And I always think about that. I was trying to protect the Mazda. So I pulled the Mazda up and parked it right in front of the garage, like right under the lip of the house. And the first thing that happened in the storm when Ike came over was it ripped a giant branch off a tree that fell down, knocked a giant hole in the roof, rolled down off the roof, landed on top of the Mazda. We heard it. It was a sickening sound. I was sure the Mazda was ruined. I was sure that my decision had just screwed up her. It was a clean little car. It's a good-ass little car. We didn't have to do nothing to it, you know? I was just sure that my decision had led to the destruction of this car. You know, that Mazda had like one scratch on it? That thing had a hell of a paint job, boy. They were doing it. Whatever Mazda was doing in 2000, they was doing it right, buddy, because that was a car. It was reliable. And by the time, because we, after that a little bit, we move up to Spring, and I'll talk more about that later, but we moved up to Spring, Texas. And that's about when the car finally started getting enough miles on it that it started, we started having some issues with it. I did a timing chain, it jumped time, and I had to do the timing chain. I remember taking that car apart to do the timing chain on it, realizing I had gotten in over my head. And my next door neighbor was a dealer mechanic and just a wonderful, he's from West Virginia and his name was Skip, and he talked like this, and he always had a Dr. Pepper in his hand, and he was a fine mechanic. And Skip sees me struggling, and Skip like unschooled me, right, is what Rage calls it, because Skip comes out, brings me the service manual for the Mazda, the dealership manual about how to do repairs, and lets me borrow some of the specialty tools I need to get this Mazda all the way apart, make it a little easier on me. I think it was a puller or something I needed that I didn't have. I was going to have to go rent it. And he brought his puller set over. He had a garage full of tools, Snap-on, and all that high-end stuff that a lot of the professionals use. And Skip didn't do any of the work for me, but he stood there and talked to me the whole time I did it. And anytime it looked like I was about to make a mistake, Skip would go, oh, I don't know if that's the way I'd go about that. I want to take a look at that book there. And I'd look, realize I was about to make a mistake, and I would fix it. And Skip Montessori'd me through that timing belt change. And I got the car running again. And Rachel got her a graphic design job. She's a very talented artist. She's a brilliant lady. And she was working down in Houston. So she needed her car. And this is like the time, like, I'm learning what it's like to be my dad, right? I'm learning what it's like to be the man, the husband or whatever. Is I got to get the car fixed so she can get to work tomorrow. You know, I got responsibilities now. And I had to stay up all night, one night, changing a fuel pump in that car with my brother in the garage because she needed to be able to get to work the next day because she had the best job at the time. We needed to make sure the food's on the table. We're living in spring. That timing belt went out on that car. I don't remember how many miles it had on it by that point. It still was clean as hell, right? She kept that car immaculate. She keeps a good car. And it was so clean. But it was starting to have it. You know, the old cars get to that point. They get to that mileage where things just start falling apart. And this is where that Mazda was. And, oh, I know what the straw was that broke the camel's back. That Mazda developed some weird wiring problem. And we could not figure it out. And it was the most intermittent problem it's ever had. But for, oh, no. Sorry, that was a Jeep. The Mazda started overheating. Mazda got a head gasket leak. Or a little crack in the head gasket. I mean, old Skip, I tore the engine down. And Skip walked me through the head gaskets on that Mazda. He had worked on a bunch of them. And I did new head gaskets on that Mazda and got it all back together. Only to find out that, and I jumped through the story. That's my fault. So, told y'all I was tired. Rachel is going to work one day, and that Mazda overheats and dies on her own 610. And she's on the side of 610, cars flying around her, and she's terrified. And I'm stuck at work in Conroe, and I can't get to her to help her. And my mother, Angel, as she was, uses her AAA membership to get Rachel towed home. And she must have... Rich said that she always felt like my mom must have told him that it was her daughter because the way they treated her so good, and they got that car home, and I decided right then and there that car had to go because I wasn't going to have my wife be in that situation again. I didn't care for that or the way it made me feel. And so I had to sell it, so me and Skip tore it down, do a head gasket on it, and get it all back together, only to find out that there must be a crack in the exhaust side of the head gasket because it's still blowing white smoke, but it's not running bad. You know, it's not misfiring or anything like that. And so, I don't know, I dumped about 3 packs of AlumiSeal off in the radiator and dumped AlumiSeal off in that radiator till it quit smoking white smoke. And it's also the transmission was starting to slip a little bit. And I listed it for sale. I think I asked about $2,500 for it at that point. It had so many miles on it, but that was a fair price, I thought. And I didn't, you know, people, oh, you put AlumiSeal in the engine. Yeah, well, whatever. I was a hillbilly. That's stuff we did. And I had cars I drove with AlumiSeal in them for years. Never had a problem. You know what I mean? It's every once in a while you get lucky that stuff works. And I'd had it work. I drove a pickup truck that I used a cracked egg to seal one time for quite a while before that radiator failed again. And once you got something fixed, you don't worry about it no more. I put that car up for sale. And the kid that bought that car, he came over with his dad, and all he could talk about, he wanted to make a race car out of that Mazda. I don't know why. I never know why kids are in the, I don't know why they like square body trucks. I don't know why the kids like things they do. I don't know why kids like the things they like, but this kid liked that Mazda, and he thought he was going to make a hot rod out of it. And I was like, more power to you, Bubba. Don't push that block too hard because it's got the aluminum seal. Didn't tell him that. But I did tell his dad. I was like, I think the transmission's slipping a little bit. And him and his dad went and test drove it, and his dad came back and was like, no, that transmission's fine. And I was like, nah, I drive it all the time. It's not, but I ain't going to argue with you because I need to sell this car. And they gave me full price for that car. They were the first people to come look at it. They gave me full top dollar for that car, which is good because we had just bought Rachel a brand new Toyota Matrix, which was a fantastic little car. That was one of the best little cars we ever owned, too. That little car was perfect. It was one of the few cars I've ever seen anybody buy new and sell and make money off of when we sold it. But we bought her this little brand new 2009 Toyota Matrix and for driving back and forth to work. That guy buys the car, and I start feeling bad because I'm like, that car wasn't in the best shape, and the people gave you top dollar for it. And about a week later, I'm driving home from work, and I drive by them people's neighborhood, and the whole front end of that car is missing. That kid, the third time he drove that car, ran into the back of a truck and totaled that car. Kid's fine. Learned a hard lesson. But the kid's fine. They're going to try to rebuild the car. But now the engine's out, transmission's out, and I feel like my karmic debt is lifted. I'm like, well, now we don't have to talk about that aluminum seal ever, you know, or that slipping transmission that I'm 100% sure was slipping. And I don't know if that kid ever got that car back together. I don't honestly give a damn. I hope he had some good learning experiences with it, and thankful he totaled it so quickly. So I didn't have to feel bad about it too long. I think that's when I was still driving my Honda Accord. I started my first contracting business in that Honda Accord, but that's good Lord, we've been here too long. That's a story for another day. The car taught me how to do the job. This car taught me how to be the husband, to be the man, be the guy responsible for making sure, you know, taking care. It helped for me in that position. Also taught me not to be afraid of things, not to get overwhelmed, that no matter how big a mechanical problem is, there's an answer somewhere and somebody's got it. Okay. It may be Skip. It may not. But a lot of times in those days it was Skip. And I lost track with Skip, but I hope he had a good life. His wife died in the driveway and we helped take care of his kid for a while, and he was a good dude. I wish I knew what happened to him. You lose track of neighbors. We had another funny neighbor there, too, but I'll talk about him another time. He was a hoot. We lived right next door to the real-life quagmire. He was great. Thank you guys for continuing to watch. I will get the audios out today. Like I said, we hadn't had power in a week. Thank you for all the well wishes. The people have reached out to check on me and my family. I am thankful to have at least enough means to be able to get my family out of town for a day or two and get them out of this heat. And then we got back and our power was, like I said, turned on last night. And I just really appreciate the people who have reached out to me and said nice things. And the people that do care about us down here and do understand the situation. It's rough and it's still a long way from being fixed. And we as Houstonians have a big battle ahead of us. And I will raise my voice with my fellow Houstonians if I think it can be of any help, because some of the things that went down here were just not right. I'm not sure if there's anything else. I mean, that car had a million stories. Like I said, that car was a big trend. That car was me and Rachel getting together. You know, we took so many trips in it to Galveston. And we took comedy road trips in it where we would go. We take trips to Midland. We put the miles on that car. We grew a lot of love in that car. We came together as one in that car. That became, you know, that car was a part of our story. It was very important. And it was a good one till it wasn't, you know. And when they're not anymore and you don't want to fool them anymore, you let them go. That's the way you do cars. You can't fall too hard in love. Otherwise, they'll break your heart every time. But you can fall in love with the right girl. And I did. I think we've been married, I don't know, 16, 17 years now. I can't even remember. Sometimes it feels like she's never not been in my life. And sometimes I can't really remember my life that well before her. Because we've had such a story together. And y'all will hear more of them, I'm sure. She's an amazing, fantastic lady. But I'm very thankful for the lessons I learned from that car. It didn't necessarily make me a car guy. I kind of already was. But it strengthened my resolve you know. And at the time, I was going through my cars and building motorbikes and whatnot. And the car just strengthened my resolve that your dad gave you the skills, or your dad helped you earn the skill set, and now the skill set's helping you be a good husband, because we didn't have money for mechanics and stuff like that. I had to do it all myself. I stepped into that role of that man, where I had to be responsible and be the one to do that. And that car taught me how to do that and not complain about it and just be the man she needed me to be. I could gush for 10 days about my love for her. And I do all the time. Comedy gave me everything I wanted. I always tell people that. A lot of people are bitter about comedy because they didn't make it big or they didn't break big. But comedy gave me everything I wanted. Comedy gave me my Rachel. Comedy gave me my kids and a lifetime of memories and experiences. Thank you guys for continuing to watch this. We'll see where it goes next week. I think next week we're going to tackle a very important, it may be a two-parter. I want to talk about my 2000 GMC Z71 because the story behind how I got that truck and everything that truck did for me is honestly one of the best vehicles I've ever owned in my life. I'm not sure I put anything else above it, and I'm not really a big GM guy. You know, it's not my preference, but that truck was one of the best trucks I ever owned in my life, for sure. One of the best vehicles all around. So I think I want to do that, but I think it's going to be a two-parter. So I don't want these things to get too long. Thank you for continuing to follow. Thank you for continuing to support the work and the things I create. I appreciate y'all being here, sharing some of your Sunday with me. I really do. I'm going to go try to get this thing edited and published by 3 p.m. We'll see how that goes. I've been up really early working on it. Love you guys. I really do. And if you're in the San Antonio, Seguin, Texas area, I am headlining the Palace Theater in Seguin, Texas, August 3rd. I know I'm not doing as many gigs right now, and there's a reason for that. I'm working on some other things, too, on the back end. But I am headlining the Palace Theater in Seguin, Texas, August 3rd. And I would love to sell that place out. So if you got some friends, something y'all want to come down for the weekend, Seguin's got all kind of cool camping spots and glamping spots. And it's a neat little town. And we're going to have a raucous hell of a good time that night. Diamond Jim's showing up. He's going to rock the room, buddy. You know, I'm good at my job. I promise you. My stand-up is not truck astrology. I'm good at my job. Come out. We'll have us a good old time. Got some new merchandise coming. Am talking some sponsors. We'll see what's happening with this thing. I'm going to continue to do this thing because I love it so much. Thank you so much for watching it. Thank you so much for your feedback. Thank you for taking this journey with me. You guys rock. I really have an incredible group of people supporting me, and I couldn't be more grateful for it. And sorry if I've been a little bit of a grouchy butthole this week, but 100 degree heat and 100 degree humidity with no power sometimes won't make you your best self. Remember what we were talking about at the beginning about how I had compassion for those people that were mean to my dad when he got the job and they didn't? This is the same situation. If you don't mind, show some of us a little compassion, because we're angry and irritable, and we'll be back to our best selves once they get the lights on. You talk about Iraq. Well, I want to talk about Iraq more than the other one. Who's going? I think I got it all. I got enough of it. Love you guys.